This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Revenge of Seven by Pittacus Lore. Performed by Neil Kaplan, Devin Sorvery, and Almari Guerra. The events in this book are real. Names and places have been changed to protect the Lorien, who remain in hiding. Other civilizations do exist. Some of them seek to destroy you.
Chapter 1. The nightmare is over. When I open my eyes, there's nothing but darkness. I'm in a bed. That much I can tell. And it's not my own. The mattress is enormous, somehow contoured perfectly to my body. And for a moment, I wonder if my friends moved me to one of the bigger beds in Nine's penthouse. I stretch my legs and arms out as far as they'll go, and I can't find the edges. The sheet draped over me is more slippery than soft, almost like a piece of plastic, and it is radiating heat. Not just heat, I realize, but also a steady vibration that soothes my sore muscles. How long have I been asleep? And where the heck am I? I try to remember what happened to me, but all I can think of is my last vision. It felt like I was in that nightmare for days. I can still smell that burned rubber stench of Washington, D.C., smog clouds lingered over the city, a reminder of the battle fought there, or the battle that will be fought there, if my vision actually comes true. The visions, are they part of a new legacy? None of the others have legacies that leave them traumatized in the morning. Are they prophecies? Threats sent by Cetricus Ra, like the dreams John and Nate used to have? Are they warnings? Whatever they are, I wish they'd stop happening. I take a few deep breaths to clean the smell of Washington out of my nostrils, even though I know it's all in my head. What's worse than the smell is that I can remember every little detail, right down to the horrified look on John's face when he saw me on that stage, with Cetricus Ra, condemning Six to death. He was trapped in the vision too, just like I was. I was powerless up there, stuck between Cetricus Ra, self-appointed ruler of Earth, and... Five. He's working for the Mogadorians. I have to warn the others. I sit bolt upright and my head swims. Too fast, too soon. Rust-colored blobs floating through my vision. I blink them away, my eyes feeling gummy, my mouth dry and throat sore. This definitely isn't the penthouse. My movement must trigger some nearby sensor, because the room's lights slowly grow brighter. They come on gradually, the room eventually bathed in a pale red glow. I look around for the source of the light, and discover it pulsing from veins interwoven through the chrome-paneled walls. A chill goes through me at how precise the room looks, how severe, lacking any decoration at all. The heat from the blanket increases, almost as if it wants me to curl back up beneath it. I shove it away. This is a Mogadorian place. I crawl across the mammoth bed. It's bigger than an SUV, big enough for a 10-foot-tall Mogadorian dictator to comfortably relax in, until my bare feet dangle over the metal floor. I'm wearing a long gray nightgown embroidered with thorny black vines. I shudder, thinking about them putting me into this gown and leaving me here to rest. They could have just killed me, but instead they put me in pajamas? In my vision, I was sitting alongside Cetricus Ra. He called me his heir. What does that even mean? Is that why I'm still alive? It doesn't matter. The simple fact is, I've been captured. I know this. Now what am I going to do about it? I figure the Moogs must have moved me to one of their bases. Except, this room isn't like the horrific and tiny cells that 9 and 6 described from when they were captured. No, this must be the Mogadorians' twisted idea of hospitality. They're trying to take care of me. Cetricus Ra wants me treated more like a guest than a prisoner. Because, one day, he wants me ruling next to him. Why? I still don't understand. But right now, it's the only thing keeping me alive. Oh no. If I'm here, what happened to the others in Chicago? My hands start to shake and tears sting my eyes. I have to get out of here, and I have to do it alone. I push down the fear. I push down the lingering visions of a decimated Washington. I push down the worries about my friends. I push it all down. I need to be a blank slate, like I was when we first fought Cetricus Ra in New Mexico. Like I was during my training sessions with the others. It's easiest for me to be brave when I just don't think about it. If I act on instinct, I can do this. Run. I imagine Creighton saying, run until they're too tired to chase you. I need something to fight them with. I look around the room for anything I can use as a weapon. Next to the bed is a metallic nightstand. The only other furniture in the room. The Moogs left a glass of water there for me, which I'm not dumb enough to drink, even though I'm insanely thirsty. Next to the glass, there's a dictionary-sized book with an oily, snaky skin cover. The ink on the cover looks singed, the words indented and rough around the edges, as if it were printed with acid for ink. The title reads, The Great Book of Mogadorian Progress, surprisingly in English. Under it are a series of angular boxes and hash marks that I assume is Mogadorian. I pick up the book and open it. Each page is divided in half, English on one side and Mogadorian on the other. I wonder if I'm supposed to read this thing. I slam the book closed. The important thing is that it's heavy, and I can swing it. I won't be turning any Mogadorian guards into ash clouds, but it's better than nothing. I climb down from the bed and walk over to what I think is the door. It's a rectangular panel cut into the plated wall, but there aren't any knobs or buttons. As I tiptoe closer, wondering how I'm going to open this thing, there's a mechanical whirring noise from inside the wall. It must be on a motion sensor like the lights, because the door hisses upward as soon as I'm close, disappearing into the ceiling. I don't stop to wonder why I'm not locked down. Clutching the Mogadorian book, I step into a hallway that's just as cold and metallic as my room. Ah, says a woman's voice, you're awake. Rather than guards, a Mogadorian woman perches on a stool outside my room, obviously waiting for me. I'm not sure if I've ever seen a female Moog before, and definitely not one like her. Middle-aged, with wrinkles forming in the pale skin around her eyes, the Moog looks surprisingly unthreatening in a high-necked, floor-length dress, like something one of the sisters would wear back at Santa Teresa. Her head is shaved except for 2 long black braids at the back of her skull, the rest of her scalp covered by an elaborate tattoo. Instead of being nasty and vicious, like the Moogs I've fought before, this one is almost elegant. I stop short in front of her, not sure what to do. The Moog glances at the book in my hands and smiles.
and ready to begin your studies, I see,
she says, getting up. She's tall, slender, and vaguely spider-like. Standing before me, she dips into an elaborate bow.
Mistress Ella, I shall be your instructor while...
As soon as her head comes low enough, I smack her across the face with the book as hard as I can. She doesn't see it coming, which I guess is strange because all the Moogs I've encountered have been ready to fight. This one lets out a short grunt and then hits the floor with a fluttering of fabric from her fancy dress. I don't stop to see if I've knocked her out or if she's pulling a blaster from some hidden compartment in that dress. I run, choosing a direction at random, and hurtling down the hallway as fast as I can. The metal floor stings my bare feet, and my muscles begin to ache, but I ignore all that. I have to get out of here. Too bad these secret Mogadorian bases never have any exit signs. I turn one corner and then another, sprinting through hallways that are pretty much identical. I keep expecting sirens to start blaring now that I've escaped, but they never do. There aren't any heavy Mogadorian footfalls chasing after me either. Just when I'm starting to get winded and thinking about slowing down, a doorway opens on my right and two Mogadorians step forward. They're more like the ones I'm used to. Burly, dressed in their black combat gear, beady eyes glaring at me. I dart around them, even though neither of them makes any attempt to grab me. In fact, I think I hear one of them laughing. What is going on here? I can feel the two Moog soldiers watching me run, so I duck down the first hallway that I can. I'm not sure if I've been going in circles or what. There isn't any sunlight or outside noises at all. Nothing to indicate that I might be getting closer to an exit. It doesn't seem like the Moogs even care what I do. Like they know I've got no chance to get out of here. I slow down to catch my breath, cautiously inching down this latest sterile hallway. I'm still clutching the book, my only weapon, and my hand is starting to cramp. I switch hands and press on. Up ahead, a wide archway opens with a hydraulic hiss. It's different from the other doors, wider, and there are strangely blinking lights on the other side. Not blinking lights, stars. As I walk under the archway, the metal-plated ceiling gives way to a glass bubble, the room wide open, almost like a planetarium, except real. There are various consoles and computers protruding from the floor. Maybe this is some kind of control room, but I ignore them, drawn instead to the dizzying view through the expansive window. Darkness. Stars. Earth. Now I understand why the Mogadorians weren't chasing me. They know there's nowhere for me to go. I'm in space. I get right up to the glass, pressing my hands against it. I can feel the emptiness outside, the endless, ice-cold, airless space between me and that floating blue orb in the distance.
Glorious, isn't it?
His booming voice is like a bucket of cold water dumped on me. I spin around and press my back to the glass, feeling like the void behind me might be preferable to facing him. Cedricus Ross stands behind one of the control panels, watching me, a hint of a smile on his face. The first thing I notice is that he's not nearly as huge as he was when we fought him at Dulce Base. Still, Cedricus Ross is tall and imposing, his broad physique clad in a stern black uniform, studded and decorated with an assortment of jagged Mogadorian medals. Three Loric pendants, the ones he took from the dead guard, hang from around his neck, glowing a subdued cobalt.
I see you've already taken up my book,
he says, gesturing to my dictionary-sized club. I didn't realize I was clutching it to my chest.
Although not necessarily in the way I'd hoped. Fortunately, your proctor wasn't badly injured.
Suddenly, in my hands, the book begins to glow red, just like the piece of debris I picked up back at Dulcie Base. I don't know exactly how I'm doing it, or even what I'm doing.
Ah,
Cedricus Ross says, watching with a raised eyebrow.
Very good.
Go to hell, I scream, and fling the glowing book at him. Before it's even halfway to him, Cedricus Ra raises one huge hand, and the book stops in midair. I watch as the glow I'd infused it with slowly fades.
Now, now, he chides me. Enough of that.
What do you want from me? I shout, frustrated tears filling my eyes.
You already know that, he replies. I showed you what's to come, just as I once showed Pittacus Lore.
Cedricus Ra hits a few buttons on the control panel in front of him, and the ship begins to move. Gradually, the Earth, seeming both impossibly far and also like it's so close I could reach out and grab it, drifts across my view. We aren't moving towards it. We're turning in place.
You are aboard the Anubis,
Cedricus Ra intones, a note of pride in his gravelly voice.
The flagship of the Mogadorian fleet.
When the ship completes its turn, I gasp. I reach out and press my hand against the glass for support, knees suddenly weak. Outside, in orbit around the Earth, is the Mogadorian fleet. Hundreds of ships, most of them long and silver, about the size of small airplanes, just like the ones the guard have described fighting before. But among them are at least 20 enormous warships that dwarf the rest. Looming and menacing, mounted cannons jutting off their angular frames, aimed right at the unsuspecting planet below. No, I whisper. This can't be happening. Cedricus Ra walks towards me, and I'm too shocked by the hopeless sight before me to even move. Gently, he drapes his hand on my shoulder. I can feel the coldness of his pale fingers through my gown.
The time has come,
he says, gazing at the fleet with me.
The great expansion has come to Earth at last. We will celebrate Mogadorian progress together, granddaughter.
Chapter 2. From the cracked second-floor window of an abandoned textile factory, I watch an old man in a ragged trench coat and filthy jeans crouch down in the doorway of the boarded-up building across the street. Once he's settled, the man pulls a brown-bagged bottle from his coat and starts drinking. It's the middle of the afternoon. I'm on watch. And he's the only living soul I've seen in this abandoned part of Baltimore since we got here yesterday. It's a quiet, deserted place, and yet it's still preferable to the version of Washington, D.C. I saw in Ella's vision. For now, at least, it doesn't look like the Mogadorians have pursued us from Chicago. Although, technically, they wouldn't have to. There's already a Mogadorian among us. Behind me, Sarah stomps her foot. We're in what used to be the foreman's office, dust everywhere. The floorboard's swollen and mildewed. I turn around just in time to see her frowning at the remains of a cockroach on the bottom of her sneaker. Careful! You might go crashing right through the floor, I tell her, only half joking.
I guess it was too much to ask for all your secret bases to be in penthouse apartments, huh?
Sarah asks, fixing me with a teasing smile. We slept in this old factory last night, our sleeping bags laid on the sunken floorboards. Both of us are filthy. It's been a couple of days since our last real shower, and Sarah's blonde hair is caked with dirt. She's still beautiful to me. Without her at my side, I might have totally lost it after the attack in Chicago, where the Moogs kidnapped Ella and destroyed the penthouse. I grimace at the thought, and Sarah's smile immediately fades. I leave the window and walk over to her. "This not knowing is killing me," I say, shaking my head. "I don't know what to do." Sarah touches my face, trying to console me.
"At least we know they won't hurt Ella. Not if what you saw in that vision is true."
"Yeah," I snort. "They'll just turn her into a brainwashed traitor, like..." I trail off, thinking of the rest of our missing friends and the turncoat they traveled with. We still haven't heard anything from Six and the others. Not that there's an easy way for them to get in touch with us. All their chests are here, and, assuming they could even try reaching us by more traditional methods, they wouldn't have the first clue how to find us, seeing as we had to flee Chicago. The only thing I know for sure is that I have a fresh scar on my leg, the fourth of its kind. It doesn't hurt anymore, but it feels like a weight. If the guard had stayed apart, if we'd kept the Loric charm intact, that fourth scar would have symbolized my death. Instead, one of my friends is dead in Florida, and I don't know how, or who, or what's happened to the rest of them. I feel in my gut that Five is still alive. I saw him in Ella's vision, standing alongside Cetricus Ra, a traitor. He must have led the others into a trap, and now one of them won't be coming back. Six, Marina, Eight, Nine, one of them is gone. Sarah wraps her hand around mine, massaging it, trying to ease some of the tension. "I can't stop thinking about what I saw in that vision," I begin, trailing off. "We'd lost, Sarah. And now it feels like it's happening for real. Like this is the beginning of the end."
"That doesn't mean anything, and you know it," Sarah replied. "Look at Eight. Wasn't there some kind of death prophecy about him? And he survived."
I frown, not stating the obvious, that Eight could be the one who was killed down in Florida.
"I know it seems bleak," Sarah continues. "And I mean, it is pretty bad, John, obviously. Good pep talk."
She squeezes my hand hard and widens her eyes at me like, "Shut up."
"But those guys down in Florida are guard," she says. "They're going to fight, they're going to keep going, and they're going to win. You have to believe, John. When you were comatose back in Chicago, we never gave up on you. We kept fighting, and it paid off. Just when it seemed like we'd lost, you saved us."
I think about the state my friends were in when I finally awoke back in Chicago. Malcolm was mortally wounded, and Sarah badly hurt. Sam nearly out of ammo, and Bernie Kosar unaccounted for. They put it all on the line for me. "You guys saved me first," I reply.
"Yeah, obviously. So return the favor and save our planet."
The way she says it, like it's no big deal, makes me smile. I pull Sarah close and kiss her.
"I love you, Sarah Hart. Love you back, John Smith."
"I love you guys too."
Sarah and I both turn to find Sam standing in the doorway, an awkward smile on his face. Curled up in his arms is a huge orange cat, one of the six Chimeri that our new Mogadorian friend brought with him, drawn to us by Bernie Kosar's rooftop howling.
Apparently, the stick BK took from Eight's chest was some kind of Chimera totem used to lead them to us, like a Loric dog whistle.
We stuck to back roads on our way to Baltimore, careful to make sure we weren't tailed. The crowded van ride gave us plenty of time to brainstorm names for our new allies. This particular chimera, preferring a chubby cat shape as its regular form, Sam insisted we name Stanley, in honor of Nine's old alter ego. If he's still alive, I'm sure Nine will be thrilled to have a fat cat with an obvious affection for Sam named after him. "Sorry," Sam says. "Did I spoil the moment?"
"Not at all,"
Sarah replies, stretching out one arm towards Sam.
"Group hug?"
"Maybe later," Sam says, looking at me. "The others are back and setting everything up downstairs." I nod, reluctantly letting go of Sarah, and walking over to the duffel bag with our supplies. "They have any problems?" Sam shakes his head. "They had to settle for just a couple of little camping generators, not enough cash for something big. Anyway, it should be enough juice." "What about surveillance?" I ask, pulling the white locator tablet and its adapter free from the duffel bag. "Adam said he didn't see any Moog scouts," Sam answers.
"Well, out of anyone, he'd know how to spot them," Sarah puts in.
"True," I reply half-heartedly, still not trusting this so-called good Moogadorian, even though he's done nothing but help us since showing up in Chicago. Even now, with him and Malcolm setting up our newly purchased electronics on the factory floor below, I feel a vague sense of unease at having one of them so close. I push it down. "Let's go." We follow Sam down a rusty spiral staircase and onto the floor of the factory proper. The place must have been closed down in a hurry, because there are still racks of musty, 80s-style men's suits pushed up against the walls, and half-full boxes of raincoats abandoned on conveyor belts. A chimera in golden retriever form that Sarah insisted we call Biscuit tumbles into our path, her teeth clenched around the ripped sleeve of a suit, locked in a tug-of-war with Dust, the gray husky. Another chimera, Gamera, which Malcolm named after some old movie monster, trundles after the others, but has trouble keeping up in his snapping turtle form. The two other new chimeri, a hawk we dubbed Regal, and a scrawny raccoon we named Bandit, watch the game from one of the inoperative conveyor belts. It's a relief to see them playing. The chimeri weren't in the best shape when Adam liberated them from Moogadorian experimentation, and they still weren't doing so hot when he brought them to Chicago. It was slow going, but I was still able to use my healing legacy to fix them up. There was something inside of them, something Moogadorian, that actually felt like it was pushing back against my powers. It even made my lumen flare up briefly, something that's never happened when using my healing. Ultimately, though, whatever the Moogs did was washed away by my legacy. I'd never actually used my healing legacy on a chimera before that night. Luckily it worked, because there was one chimera in even worse condition than all our new friends. "Have you seen BK?" I asked Sam, scanning the room for him. I had found him on the roof of the John Hancock Center, shredded by Moogadorian blaster fire and barely clinging to life. I used my healing on him, praying that it would work. Even though he's better now, I've still been keeping an extra close eye on him, probably because the fates of so many of my other friends are unknown. "There," Sam replies, pointing. At one end of the room, against a wall covered with competing graffiti tags, are a trio of industrial-size laundry bins overflowing with piles of khaki pants. It's at the summit of one of those piles that Bernie Kosar rests, the antics of Biscuit and Dust seeming to tire him out. Despite my healing, he's still weak from the fight in Chicago, and also missing a jagged chunk from one of his ears. but with my animal telepathy, I can sense a sort of contentedness coming off him as he watches the other Chimeri. When BK sees us enter, his tail thumps fresh dust clouds from the pile of old clothes. Sam sets down Stanley, and the cat trundles over to the clothes pile with BK, settling into what I guess is the designated Chimera napping zone.
Never thought I'd have my own Chimera, Sam says, much less a half a dozen of them.
And I never thought I'd be working with one of them, I reply, my gaze settling on Adam. At the center of the factory floor, steelwork benches are bolted into the floor. Sam's dad, Malcolm, and Adam are setting up the computer equipment they just purchased by trading in some of my waning supply of Loric gemstones. Because there's no electricity running to this old factory, they had to buy some small battery-powered generators for the trio of laptops and mobile hotspot. I watch Adam hooking up one of the laptop batteries, his deathly pale skin, lank black hair, and angular features making him slightly more human-looking than the usual Mogadorians, and remind myself that he's on our side. Sam and Malcolm seem to trust him. Plus, he's got a legacy, the power to create shockwaves, which he inherited from one. If I hadn't seen him use the legacy with my own eyes, I'm not sure I'd even think it was possible. Part of me wants to believe, maybe even needs to believe, that a Moog wouldn't be able to just steal a legacy, that he has to be worthy, that it happened for a reason.
Look at it this way, Sam says quietly as we walk over to the others. Humans, Loric, Moogs. We've got like the first meeting of the Intergalactic United Nations over here. It's historic.
I snort and step up to the laptop Adam has just finished connecting. He takes one look at me and must detect something. Maybe I'm not doing such a good job concealing my conflicted feelings, because he looks down and steps aside, making room for me and moving on to the next laptop. He keeps his eyes fixed on the screen, typing quickly. How'd it go? I ask.
We got most of the gear we need, Malcolm replies as he fiddles with a wireless router.
Even with his beard starting to get majorly unkempt, Malcolm looks healthier than he did when I first met him.
Anything happen here?
Nothing, I say, shaking my head. It'd take a miracle for the guard in Florida to track us down. And Ella, I keep hoping her voice will pop into my head and tell me where they took her. But she hasn't made contact.
At least we'll know where the others are once the tablet is hooked up, Sarah says.
With the gear we bought, I think we can run a hack on the John Hancock building's phone network, Malcolm suggests. That way, if they try calling in from the road, we can intercept the call.
Good idea, I reply, plugging the white locator tablet into the laptop and waiting for it to boot up. Malcolm pushes his glasses up his nose and clears his throat.
It was Adam's idea, actually.
Oh, I reply, keeping my voice neutral.
That is a good idea, Sarah chimes in.
She scoots in next to Malcolm and starts working on the third laptop, giving me a look like I should try saying something nice to Adam. When I don't, an awkward silence settles over the group. There have been a lot of those since we left Chicago. Before it can get too weird, the tablet boots up. Sam peers over my shoulder.
They're still in Florida, Sam says.
There's a solitary dot for me on the tablet, pulsing on the East Coast, and then miles to the south are the four dots for the surviving guard. Three of the dots are bunched together, basically overlapping into one glowing blob, while a fourth is a short distance away. Immediately, scenarios for that isolated dot begin circling through my head. Was one of our friends captured?
Did they have to separate after they were attacked? Is that five apart from the others? Does that prove he's a traitor? Like in my vision? I'm distracted from these thoughts by the fifth dot on the tablet. Literally an ocean away from the others. This one hovers over the Pacific. Its glow a little dimmer than the rest. That must be Ella, I say, my brow furrowing. But how... Before I can finish my question, Ella's dot flickers and disappears. A second later, before I can even process my panic, Ella blinks back to life, now hovering over Australia. What the hell? Sam asks, staring over my shoulder. It's moving so fast, I say. Maybe they're transporting her somewhere. The dot disappears again, then reappears at an impossible point over Antarctica, nearly off the edge of the tablet's screen. For the next few seconds, it flickers in and out, bouncing across the map. I smack the side of the tablet with my palm out of frustration. They're scrambling the signal somehow, I say. We've got no chance of finding her while it's like this. Sam points to the others clustered around Florida. If they were going to hurt Ella, wouldn't they have done it already?
Cetricus Ra wants her, Sarah puts in, looking at me. I had told them all about that nightmare scene in D.C., and Ella ruling alongside Cetricus Ra. It's still hard for any of us to believe, but at least it gives us one advantage. We know what Cetricus Ra wants. I hate to leave her out there, I say grimly. But I don't think he'll harm her. Not yet, anyway.
At least we know where the others are, Sam insists. We need to get down there before someone else.
Sam's right, I decide, driven by the sinking feeling that one of those dots could blink out at any moment. They might need our help.
I think that would be a mistake, Adam says. His voice is tentative, but there's still enough Moog harshness to make my fists clench from reflex.
I'm not used to having one of them around.
I turn to stare at him.
What did you say?
A mistake, he repeats. It's predictable, John. It's a reactionary move. This is why my people always catch up to you.
I can feel my jaw working, trying to form a response. But mostly, I just want to punch his face in.
I'm about to take a step forward when Sam puts a hand on my shoulder.
Easy, Sam says quietly.
You want us to just sit around here and do nothing? I ask Adam, trying to keep my cool. I know I should hear him out, but this whole situation has me feeling cornered. And now I'm supposed to take advice from a guy whose species has been hunting me for my entire life?
Of course not, Adam replies, looking up at me with those coal-colored Mogadorian eyes.
Then what? I snap. Give me one good reason we shouldn't go to Florida.
I'll give you two, Adam replies. First, if the rest of the guard are in danger or captured as you suspect, then their continued survival hinges on luring you in. They are useful only as bait.
You're saying it could be a trap?
I reply through gritted teeth. If they are captured, then yes, of course it is a trap. On the other hand, if they are free, what good will your heroic intervention do? Aren't they highly trained and perfectly capable of getting themselves out of trouble?
What can I say to that?
No. 6 and 9, pretty much the two most badass people I know, aren't capable of escaping from Florida and tracking us down?
But what if they're down there waiting for us to come get them?
I shake my head, still feeling like I want to throttle at him.
So what are we supposed to do in the meantime? I ask him. Just sit around and wait for them?
We can't do that, Sam jumps in. We can't just leave them. They have no way of finding us.
Adam spins his laptop around so I can see the screen. Between kidnapping Ella and killing a guard in Florida, my people will believe they have you on the run once again.
They won't be expecting a counter-strike.
On the laptop, Adam has pulled up satellite photographs of an expanse of suburbia. It looks like a totally generic, wealthy community. When I look a little closer, I notice a paranoid number of security cameras mounted on the imposingly tall stone wall that encircles the entire property.
This is Ashwood Estates, just outside of Washington, D.C., Adam continues. It's home to the top-ranking Mogadorians assigned to North America. With the Plum Island facility wrecked and Chimeri recovered, I think we should focus our attack here.
What about the mountain base in West Virginia? I ask. Adam shakes his head.
That is a military installation only, kept out of sight so my people's forces can mass there. We'd have a hard time taking it down now. And anyway, the real power, the true-born Mogadorians, the leaders, they reside in Ashwood.
Malcolm clears his throat. I tried to relay everything you told me about the Trueborns, Adam, but maybe it'd be better if you explained it.
Adam looks around at us, a bit apprehensive.
I don't know where to begin.
You can skip the whole Mogadorian birds and the bees speech, Sam says, and I stifle a smile.
It has to do with the bloodlines, right? I say, prompting him.
Yeah. Trueborn are the pure bloodlines. Mogadorians born of Mogadorian parents. Like me,
Adam says, slouching a bit. His trueborn status is no great point of pride.
The others, the Vatborn, are the soldiers you fought most often. They are not born, but grown, thanks to the science of Cetricus Ra.
Is that why they disintegrate? Sarah asks. Because they're not, like, real Moogs?
They're bred for combat, not for burying, Adam replies.
Doesn't sound like much of a life, I say.
You Moogs worship Cetricus Ra for that?
As the historians contained in the great book tell it, our people were dying off before the so-called beloved leader came along. The Vatborn and Cetricus Ra's genetic research saved our species.
Adam pauses, a sneer forming as he thinks this over.
Of course, Cetricus Ra also wrote the great book, so who knows?
Fascinating, Malcolm says.
Yeah, definitely more about Mogadorian breeding than I ever wanted to know, I say, turning back to the laptop. If this place is filled with high-ranking Moogs, won't it be heavily guarded?
There will be guards, yes. But not enough to make a difference, he replies. You need to understand, my people feel safe here. They are used to being the hunters, not the hunted.
So what? I continue. We kill a few trueborn Moogs and that's it? What difference does that make?
Any losses in trueborn leadership will have wide-ranging impacts on Mogadorian operations. The Vatborn are not particularly good at directing themselves.
Adam traces his finger across the immaculately kept lawns of Ashwood Estates.
Plus, there are tunnels beneath these houses.
Malcolm walks around to our side of the table, crossing his arms as he looks at the images.
I thought you destroyed those tunnels, Adam.
I damaged them, yes, Adam replies. But they stretch far beyond the rooms we were in. Even I am not entirely sure what we might find down there.
Sam looks from Adam to his father.
Is that where?
It's where they held me,
Malcolm answers.
Where they took my memories, and where Adam rescued me.
It's possible we can find a way to restore your memories,
Adam says, sounding eager to help Malcolm.
If the equipment wasn't too badly damaged.
What Adam's saying makes sense, but I can't quite bring myself to admit it. I've spent my entire life running and hiding from Mogadorians, fighting them, killing them. They've taken everything from me. And now, here I am, making battle plans alongside one. It just doesn't feel right.
Not to mention we're talking about a full frontal assault on a Mogadorian compound with none of the other guard backing me up. As if on cue, Dust wanders over and sits down next to Adam's feet. He reaches down to absently scratch behind its ears.
If the animals trust him, shouldn't I be able to?
Whatever we find in those tunnels,
Adam continues, probably knowing I'm not sold.
I am certain it will provide valuable insight into their plans. If your friends are captured or being tracked, we will know for sure once I've accessed the Mogadorian systems.
What if one of them dies while we're on this mission of yours?
Sam asks, his voice cracking a little at the thought.
What if they die because we didn't rescue them when we had the chance?
Adam pauses, thinking this over.
I know this must be hard for you,
he says, looking between me and Sam.
I admit, it's a calculated risk.
Calculated risk, I repeat. Those are our friends you're talking about.
Yeah, Adam replies. And I'm trying to help keep them alive.
Logically, I know Adam really is trying to help. But I'm stressed, and I've been brought up not to trust his kind. Before I know what I'm doing, I take a step towards him and jab a finger into his chest.
This better be worth it, I tell him. And if something happens in Florida,
I'll take responsibility, he replies. It'll be on me. If I'm wrong, John, you can dust me.
If you're wrong, I probably won't need to,
I say, staring into his eyes. Adam doesn't look away. Sarah loudly whistles between her fingers, getting everyone's attention.
If we can put the whole macho posturing thing on hold for a second, I think you guys should take a look at this.
I step around Adam, telling myself to cool down, and look over Sarah's shoulder at the website she's pulled up.
I was looking up news stories about Chicago, and this popped up, she explains. It's a pretty slick-looking website.
Except for the all-caps headlines and sheer amount of flying saucer gifs cluttering the sidebars. The stories listed under Most Popular, all of the links in a neon green that I guess is supposed to look alien include Mogadorians undermining government and Earth's Lorik protectors driven into hiding.
The page Sarah currently has open features a picture of the burning John Hancock Center along with the headline,
Mog Attack in Chicago. Is this the Zero Hour?
The website is called They Walk Among Us.
Oh, jeez, Sam groans, joining the huddle around Sarah's computer. Not these creeps.
What is this? I ask Sarah, squinting at the story on the screen.
These dudes used to be strictly into the old-school black-and-white zine style, Sam says. Now they're on the Internet. I can't decide if that makes them better or worse.
The Moogs killed them, I point out. How does this even exist in any form?
I guess there's a new editor, Sarah says. Check this out.
Sarah clicks into the website's archives, going back to the first story ever posted. The headline reads, Paradise High School Attack, Start of Alien Invasion. Below that is a grainy cell phone picture of the destruction around our high school's football field. I quickly skim the article. The level of detail is astounding. It's like whoever wrote this was there with us.
Who's Jolly Roger 182?
I ask, looking at the screen name credited in the post. Sarah looks up at me with an odd smile, bewilderment mixing with something like pride.
You're going to think I'm crazy, she says.
What's a Jolly Roger anyway? Sam asks, thinking out loud. The pirate flag?
Yeah, Sarah replies, nodding. Like the Paradise High Pirates, whose old quarterback happens to be one of the only other people outside our group to know what went down at the high school.
I widen my eyes at Sarah.
No way. Yes, way, she replies. I think Jolly Roger 182 is Mark James.
Chapter 3. The Mogadorians, along with their cronies from the corrupted branches of national security, are believed to have fought a protracted battle in New Mexico against the heroic guard, Sam reads aloud. My sources believe the Mogadorians were forced to retreat after their leader sustained an injury. The whereabouts of the guard remain unknown.
He's right on the money, Malcolm says, turning to me. But where is he getting his information?
No idea, I reply. We didn't exactly stay in touch after Paradise.
I lean over Sam's shoulder to check out the next story.
I'm baffled by the amount of information Mark James, or whoever this is, has posted to They Walk Among Us. There are details of our battle at Dulce Base, early speculation about the attack in Chicago, frightening essays about what Moogs look like and what they're capable of, and posts rallying humanity in support of the Lorik. There are also articles covering topics that I've never considered, even ones about which members of the U.S. government are in league with the Mogadorians. Sam clicks through to a story where Mark accuses the Secretary of Defense, a man named Bud Sanderson, of using his political clout to pave the way for a Mogadorian invasion. Another click yields a second article about Sanderson, one with the tabloid-friendly headline, Corrupt SOD Using Mogadorian Genetic Treatments. The story is tied to an image of Sanderson from 5 years ago, juxtaposed with one of him from a few months ago. In the first, Sanderson looks like a haggard man in his late 70s. His face is age-spotted, and he has a double chin and a steep paunch. In the second, he's lost weight and has a healthy glow and a full head of silver hair. It's almost as if he's time-traveled. In fact, I bet most people would think the picture was a hoax, like it's a photo of Sanderson from 20 years ago with a fake timestamp. But if you take Mark at his word, something's definitely changed with the Secretary of Defense. Something way bigger than diet and exercise, or even plastic surgery. Sam shakes his head, not buying it.
How would Mark possibly know all this? I mean, Sarah, you went out with him. Did he even know how to read?
Yes, Sam, Sarah replies, rolling her eyes. Mark could read.
But he was never, journalistically inclined, was he? This is like WikiLeaks over here.
People tend to change when they find out aliens are real, Sarah responds. It looks to me like he's been trying to help. We don't know for sure that it's Mark, I say, frowning. I look over at Adam. He's been quiet since we started exploring the They Walk Among Us website, listening to us with a hand on his chin, thoughtful. Could this be some kind of trap? I ask him, figuring it's best to consult the expert.
Of course, he says without hesitation. Although if it is, it's an elaborate one. And even for the sake of trapping you, I find it hard to believe Cetricus Ra would admit to being driven off from Dulce Base.
Is it true? Malcolm asks. What he's written about the Secretary of Defense.
I don't know, Adam replies. It very well could be.
I'm going to email him, Sarah announces, opening up a new browser tab.
Hold on,
Adam says quickly, a bit more polite than when he slammed my idea to try rescuing the others.
If this Mark person really does have access to all this highly secret intel, Sam chuckles, my people will almost certainly be monitoring his communications.
Adam concludes, raising an eyebrow at Sam. He turns back to Sarah.
They'll also definitely be monitoring your email.
Sarah slowly lifts her hands away from the keyboard. Can't you do anything about that?
I know how their cyber tracking systems work. It was something I excelled at during my training. I could write an encryption code, reroute our IP address through servers in different cities.
Adam turns to me like he wants permission.
They'd unravel it eventually. We'd have to leave this place within 24 hours to be safe.
Do it, I tell him. Better that we keep moving anyway. Adam immediately begins typing commands into his laptop. Sam rubs his hands together and leans over Adam's shoulder.
You should reroute them to as many crazy places as possible. Make them think Sarah's in Russia or something.
Adam smirks.
Consider it done.
It takes Adam about 20 minutes to write some code that will reroute our IP address through a dozen far-flung locations. I think back to the elaborate computer system Henri always had set up, and the even more complicated grid that Sandor built in Chicago. Then I imagine 100 Mogadorians, just like Adam, hunched over keyboards stalking us. I never doubted our sapons were justified in their paranoia. But seeing Adam work, I finally realized just how necessary it was.
Whoa,
Sarah says when she's finally able to open her email. The list of bold-faced, unread mail consists entirely of messages from Mark James.
It really is him.
Or the Moogs hacked his email, Sam suggests.
Doubtful, Adam replies. My people are thorough, sure, but this seems kind of roundabout.
I glance over the email headings, lots of exclamation points and capital letters. A few months ago, the idea of Mark James spamming my girlfriend would have gotten under my skin. But now, it seems like our rivalry was something that happened to someone else. Something from another life.
When was the last time you checked this?
I ask.
Weeks ago. I don't really remember, Sarah replies. I've been a little busy.
She opens the most recent message from Mark, and we all lean in to examine the contents.
Sarah, I don't know why I keep sending these emails.
Part of me hopes that you're reading them, using them to help the Lorik, and can't reply for your own safety. Another part of me worries that you aren't even out there, that you're gone. I refuse to believe that, but I need to hear from you. I thought I had a lead on you in New Mexico. All I found there was a deserted military base. It looked like a major battle went down, way bigger and nastier than what happened in Paradise. I hope you guys got out safe. I hope like hell I'm not the only one left to fight these assholes. That would suck. A friend of mine set up a safe house for me, way off the grid. A place where we can work on exposing those pale freaks to the world. If you can get in touch, I'll find a way to send you the coordinates. We're on to something big. Something international. I don't even know what to do with it. If you're reading these, if you're still in contact with John, now would be a really good time to show up. I need your help. Mark. Sarah turns to me, her eyes wide with sudden passion, face set determinedly. I've seen that look before. Know it well. It's the look she gives me right before telling me she wants to do something dangerous. Without her even saying anything, I already know that Sarah wants to find Mark James. The dashboard clock reads 7:45. We've got 15 minutes until the bus leaves for Alabama. I've got 15 minutes left with Sarah Hart. 15 minutes was about how long it took Adam to encrypt Sarah's email against any Mogadorian hackers. She got off a quick note to Mark, who replied almost immediately with an address for a restaurant in Huntsville. He told Sarah he'd watch the place for the next few days and, If she really was Sarah Hart, he'd pick her up there and spirit her off to his secret hideout.